Hi, my name is Claire Lombardo, and I'm here to talk about my new novel, which is called Same As It Ever Was.
Claire Lombardo's new novel, Same As It Ever Was, follows Julia Ames through multiple timelines that explore her role as daughter, wife, and mother. When she runs into a figure from her past at a grocery store, Julia is forced to revisit and reckon with her decisions that affected every relationship in her present. I recently spoke with Claire Lombardo about capturing Julia's voice throughout the decades and the challenges of writing a second novel following the success of her debut, The Most Fun We Ever Had. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Claire Lombardo. The book comes out today, so could you give our listeners a description of Same As It Ever Was?
Sure. Yeah. So Same As It Ever Was is, I like to look at it as sort of a woman's life story told out of order. So it is about a woman named Julia Ames. At the beginning of the novel, when we meet her, she is in her 50s. She is living what appears to be a very charmed life in the Chicago suburbs with a really nice husband and almost grown children who are doing well. But she runs into an old friend at the grocery store who she both didn't expect to see and really didn't want to see again. And that kind of sets her off on this inward journey, thinking about some parts of her past that got her to where she is. So we follow her through her 30s when she does some sort of scandalous things. And then we see her as a child. And so we kind of see her life from a lot of different angles and see what made her.
As you mentioned, we get to know Julia through these different timelines. When we first meet her in the grocery store, she's 57. And then through flashbacks, we see her as a new mother. Or back when she's a little girl, or when she meets her husband, Mark. I think she was in her late 20s then, when she's 17. Talk to me about how these various timelines reveal what the reader should know about Julia and how you chose, like, which moment of her life to flashback to.
That's a really good question. In some ways, it was a very random or sort of intuitive decision. And then in some ways, there was a lot of mechanizing that I did after doing all of the writing. So in terms of like choosing scenes, that relates to point of view for me. So I kind of, not to sound like a crazy person, but I sort of let Julia decide what moments of her life were the most pressing or the most interesting. And what I love about that is that it's not always going to be the most cinematic moments or like the biggest moments. That's certainly been the case for me. Some of the biggest moments in my life have not been what you would think. And so with Julia, it's kind of a mix. We do see, you know, when she meets her husband, which is sort of a, you know, cinematically big thing, but we also see a lot of quiet moments. She does a lot of contemplation. She spends a lot of time alone. So it was a matter of kind of collecting all of these almost snapshots of her. And then when I finally finished a draft, it was a matter of figuring out the best order to reveal them to the reader, to maintain tension, to kind of draw out their empathy for her as they read, ideally. And as you said, we meet Julia as a child, which for me is always sort of a good cognitive trick, both in fiction and with real people. If there's someone that you're sort of having a hard time with, if you picture them being a little kid, it kind of makes them easier to empathize with or to understand. So yeah, that was difficult. It was difficult to lay out the novel and to kind of figure out what to reveal when, because it's not a hugely plotty novel. I shouldn't say that because it's not, you know, a great selling point, but it's a life story. So not every moment in someone's life is going to be hugely plotty, but it was fun for me to kind of figure out how to take these small moments and use them to ideally create a pretty taut line of tension.
It's not a plotty novel, but it certainly was a slow burn. I mean, it did
thanks.
Feel like it was building.
I'd love
and building.
To hear that.
Yeah. Yeah. So one relationship that has shaped Julia as a person is the one that she has with her mother, Anita. Talk to me about their relationship and how that influences her relationships she has with her own children.
So Julia is, she comes to motherhood sort of reluctantly, herself, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that her own mother came pretty reluctantly and sort of maybe against her will to motherhood. So Julia is raised by a single mother who's not that interested in being a mother to her, and who kind of uses inattention and ambivalence as weapons against Julia as a child. So it's this very sort of subtle but very damaging psychological approach that Julia is raised with. And so then she meets Mark, who is very enthusiastic about, kind of embarking on a conventional looking life, and ends up doing that with him, and then finds herself feeling like she lacks the right tools because she didn't really have a model. And so then she meets a woman named Helen Russo, who is sort of the opposite of her mother, who is a corporate litigator who had five children and really loves spending time with them and has raised them all and sent them out of the nest and is, very satisfied with her life and makes everything look really easy. And so Julia is very entranced by that. And so Julia's mothering, I would say, is influenced both by her own mother and by this sort of chosen mother that she finds in Helen Russo, which was fun to play around with. I think it's a endlessly fruitful relationship in fiction, parental relationships in general in fiction. So it was fun to kind of explore it from all of those different angles.
I want to ask about her relationship with Helen because even though it was short-lived, it was clearly important to her because it was almost like she was a surrogate mother. And to me, it helped shape, in a way, how Julia later related to Sonny, or did I read into that wrong? And Sonny is Julia's son's fiance.
No, I think that's a really excellent point. So Julia finds she's very resistant to her son getting married, and she has a hard time embracing Sonny in the same way that she has a hard time embracing anyone. But I very much think that her relationship with Helen influences it because I think for the first time she sees herself as a woman who younger women might actually look up to. I think she has this moment of like, oh, my life actually looks kind of okay. And she's never really felt like that before. So she, with Sunny, feels this sort of conflicting. She doesn't have the effortless, motherly, big sisterly air that Helen has with her. But she wonders if she should have it. And I think she does draw from being young and being lost and being about to embark on parenthood or being, already embarking on parenthood, and having this, kind of magical person sweep in. So she struggles with that, how to, whether she should be doing that or not. So there definitely are parallels between those. Yeah.
So much of what we read is Julia's inner monologue. And I think because the present day run-in with Helen in the grocery store immediately flashes back to when they first met, Julia at that time feels very internal and perhaps depressed and not very, like, not talking to the other moms at daycare and whatnot. And even later, there's a different Julia that we meet when she and Mark first meet, because that person is completely different to me than the one that we meet at the botanical gardens when Ben is little. So it took me a while to realize just how cynical and sardonic she is. Did her internal voice change for you as you wrote her?
It did. That's a really good way to look at it. It definitely did. I think when I was writing those present sections, when Julia is in her 50s, she's still sardonic and catty, and she can be kind of mean in her observations of people, but she's happier, I think. And so that overall mood kind of governed the way that I wrote her versus, like you said, when she's in her 30s at the botanical garden, very depressed, very isolated. Her thoughts almost have a manic quality to them. She's not sleeping. She's not talking to anyone, not even her husband. She spends her days with a toddler and really only talks to him. So I definitely wanted her monologue to reflect that. So yeah, I think with each sort of Julia era, I did kind of take the emotional temperature. That sounds very like woo-woo, but I did sort of, try to figure out where her head was at and let that dictate how the point of view felt. Same with, I mean, her as a 7-year-old. Julia is a sort of cynical 7-year-old also, but she's hopeful in a way that she's not at any other point in her life because she hasn't been, my dog is making a nest behind me if you hear that noise. But she's hopeful in a way that she isn't in any of the other iterations we see of her, because she hasn't been kind of beaten down by the world yet. So no, I think that's absolutely true.
You know, I mentioned all these timelines. Was one moment of Julia easier to write than the others? Was any timeline easier to write than the other?
That's a really good question. I started off with the timeline, I'll call the botanical garden timeline, when Julia is a young mom. And that voice just came really easily to me. I think because it was probably demographically close to where I'm at in my life. So her references and her just way of looking at the world felt familiar to me. And it's also her voice is very kinetic then, for better or for worse. So it came easily. I think I struggled sometimes with present day Julia because she is more settled. And I think it's actually harder to write happy people than it is to write miserable people, because miserable people have a lot to say, and you know, not complain about, but they have a lot of grievances to air, I guess. Whereas, you know, Julia in the present arc is relatively happy and is relatively settled and is more secure in herself and in her place in the world than she used to be. So she just doesn't have as much, there's less for her to talk about, I guess, because she is contented. She's sort of, she says at the beginning of the novel something like, she can't believe how improbably lovely her life is, and happy people living lovely lives are just less interesting, I guess, than their counterparts.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that you relate more to the Julia who is more of your demographic. I'm not going to ask how old you are, but I have a feeling that you're much younger than your protagonist. And I know this is what authors do. They write about and embody fictional people who are not them. But this novel feels lived. Are you an old soul, or do you just credit that to observation?
I've made the joke before that maybe I'm just like a sociopath, which I guess is possible. I have been called an old soul. Well, I think part of it too that is actually related to this book is that I've had the very good fortune of having a number of Helen Russo-esque figures in my life. And I have always, since I was a teenager, had friends who were quite a bit older than I am. And even now I'm in my 30s, some of my closest friends are in their 50s or 60s. And that's just such a gift. And I mean, I didn't do it on purpose. It's just sort of how it's worked out. But I think I've always had the benefit of that, of having people in my life who have lived more life, lived different life, and have been generous in sharing their experiences with me, and vice versa. There's a benefit, I think, going in both directions. But I think that's very much part of it. So that was something that I wanted to explore in this book, Julia in her 30s, making friends with this woman in her 60s and having it be one of the most profound relationships of her life. Because I've again, been lucky to have a number of those. But I also just think, I'm just really interested in... I've only written two novels, so I can't speak, you know, more broadly, but with both of my books, it would have been very hard for me to just stop at looking at, you know, a single year of someone's life. I'm very nosy and just, you know, once I get interested in people, I want to see what happens. And so I think with Julia, I quote unquote met her in my head when she was in her 30s. But the more time I spent with her in her 30s, the more I wanted to see, what did this person look like as a kid? And what is she going to look like, you know, 30 years from this moment when she's really having a hard time? And I think it's easier than it seems to do that. I think it has to do with how much time you're spending with your characters. I spent years with her, and the better I got to know her, I think the easier it was for me, just intuitively, even just looking at my own life, to see how she might react in certain situations, and then how she might react in certain situations plus or minus 10 years or 20 years or, you know, what have you. Yeah.
I was going to ask you if you had a Helen Russo in your life. I'd like to be a Helen Russo for somebody.
Me too. I know. Yeah. I feel really, I actually, in the acknowledgments of my book, I thank all of my Helen Russos, whether they know it or not. And I think some of my friends very much do know that they're my Helen Russos, but some don't. And some, you know, kind of came into my life and left. But it's something that I've always had. And I know it's not the norm. So I feel really lucky.
So Julia went to Kansas State University, and we are in Wichita, just 2 hours south of there.
Yeah.
Do you have a Kansas connection?
No, I don't. And it's funny, actually, Kansas appeared in this novel in the same way that Iowa appeared in my first novel. I needed a college town that she could have accessed easily. And in the novel, Kansas is the furthest Julia can affordably get away from her mother when she is a teenager. So that is where she goes.
Okay, so I was flipping through the book when writing these questions, and I noticed when I was flipping back at the beginning, I noticed the toy giraffe Ben was carrying that appeared later in a flashback. And I'm usually a very careful reader, but this surprised me that I hadn't noticed like this nuanced detail before. And I also never have time to reread books, but I wonder if I should go back and see what else I might have missed, especially with the nonlinear timeline. Do you reread books? And is this one that gets better and better as you read it again and again?
That's a good question. I do reread books. I did reread my own, I guess, when I was writing it. I'm very much a rereader. And I think I've had that experience with novels like Middlesex, which I've read probably, you know, at least many times. And I think with books like that, and with books that cover a lot of time, have a lot of characters, you know, are sort of juggling a lot in terms of plot, it's always sort of a lovely and rich experience to read things over. I teach sometimes, and my rule for my students when they're reading each other's work is to always read a story twice or a novel excerpt, because you will catch things, even if the writer didn't intend for you to catch things. And so I think with The Same As It Ever Was, I do think, I mean, it would be a tall order to ask someone to reread this book, because it's, you know, 409, I don't know how many pages it ended up being, but there are a lot of those, like that moment you described, that's the fun, one of the fun parts of fiction writing for me, is that after you have a draft, you get to play around with the details that then make it feel cohesive and make the reader realize, oh yeah, that was the thing that the grandmother gave him, or that's the same scarf that she was wearing in this scene. And those are just those little details that I think make fiction feel true and make readers feel complicit in the whole operation, which I love. I love sort of increasing my communication with readers. And it's a great feeling when you're reading something and you like recognize something. It makes you feel so smart, or it makes me feel smart. So, yeah.
So Same As It Ever Was is your second novel, and your first, The Most Fun We Ever Had, was released in 2019, but it's having a resurgence now. It was selected for Reese's Book Club this past April. How did the writing process of Same As It Ever Was compare to that of your first novel?
That's a really good question. It was a lot harder. I wrote most of The Most Fun We Ever Had never thinking it would see the light of day, and not even really acknowledging that I was writing a novel. I worked on it in the evenings when I was, you know, after work, I had other jobs. I would work on it on the subway or on my lunch break. It was just sort of it was a hobby. It was fun. And then I got to graduate school with a draft of it. And I put that draft in a drawer and I started writing about Julia. And so I think on a craft level, it's a slightly different book, just because my understanding of fiction changed while I was writing it. But I also think, right, I've heard other people, I don't know if other writers have said this to you, that the second book is the hardest to write. And I hope that is true, because I had a miserable time writing this book. Because there's suddenly expectations where there were none, which, to be clear, having expectations is wonderful and having readers is incredible. But with the first book, I didn't have those things. So I felt, I think, more freedom to do whatever I wanted and try weird stuff and just sort of move forward without ever thinking that anyone would read it. And with the second book, you're sort of haunted by the, you know, that person said that thing about me in that publication or whatever. I don't hope most writers are prone to that, but I hope I'm not the only writer who does that. But yeah, I think it's a different book. And I think it's, I also wrote a lot of it during COVID. And so I think tonally, it's just inevitably going to be a different book. I think it's a little bit darker than the first book, maybe just because I spent several years writing it alone in my house with my dog, not talking to anyone. So it felt a lot more arduous in a lot of ways. And it was harder because it has one point of view and the first novel had seven, mm-hmm. which you would think would be harder, but I actually found it much more difficult to be in one person's head for 400 pages. So,
and for 30 years, 20 years.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
50 years at times. Well, the book is Same As It Ever Was. Claire Lombardo, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a delight.
That was Claire Lombardo, author of the book Same As It Ever Was, which was published by Doubleday. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.